With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Quentin Tarantino's movie Inglourious Basterds looks at a Jewish commando unit in World War II that basically uses the tactics of Vlad the Impaler, psychological terror, to scare Nazis into submission. Now, of course, the movie isn't historically accurate because it ends with Adolf Hitler being killed in France, but believe it or not, there was a real-life secret commando unit of Jews fighting in World War II, although they have almost no bearing whatsoever to the Quentin Tarantino movie. Today's guest is Leah Garrett, and she's the author of the new book X Troop, The Secret Jewish Commandos of World War II. She interviewed some of the last surviving members of this unit, and their story really is incredible. There were many Jewish refugees from Nazi Germany or Austria who came to Britain. And Winston Churchill and his chief of staff convinced these refugees, many of whom had been held in British internment camps through their nationality, to fight for the Brits. These soldiers played important roles in such major contests as D-Day and the Battle of the Bulge. And here we see incredible heroics, like Peter Master's bicycle ride through occupied France, where he killed and interrogated German soldiers across Normandy. Leah also talks about one of the most dramatic little-known rescues of the war, in which ex-trooper Freddie Gray drove a commandeered jeep across hundreds of miles of German territory to free his parents from a concentration camp. And finally, we discuss the troubled legacy of the ex-troop unit in England, where the commando's Jewish heritage has been largely ignored and, in some cases, suppressed. This is an unexplored aspect of the Jewish experience during World War II, where it's mostly understood as the horrors of concentration camps, and that's definitely an aspect of it, a huge aspect. But this is a whole other side to this story. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Leah Garrett. Leah, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I am so excited to be here and a huge fan of the show. So thank you.
Well, thank you very much. This is a very interesting chapter in World War II history, and it's impossible for all but the most scholarly of World War II listeners to not compare your topic to Inglourious Basterds. So we know that that movie takes liberties with the truth because Adolf Hitler did not die in France. As the History Channel tells us, he and Eva Braun escaped to Argentina and lived there until the 1970s, as everybody knows. But how factually correct is Inglourious Basterds, at least the parts that aren't obviously taking liberties with the historical record?
Okay, so the book I wrote about is about the X-Troop, which was a secret unit of Jewish commandos who went and caught and captured and interrogated Nazis. And when Inglourious Basterds came up, there was a really big backlash from the families of the original commandos that I write about, including one of their daughters who writes for The Hollywood Reporter, and she wrote a rebuttal to the film, basically saying, the real story of my father, the real Inglourious Basterds was completely different in a very basic way. In the Tarantino movie, it's all about revenge and anger and rage. For the actual ex-troopers, it was all about acting ethically and following the rules of war. So whenever they were given these instances in which they could enact revenge, they didn't do it. It was extraordinary when I wrote this book. In fact, I was speaking to somebody from West Point about it, and they want to use instances from this book to train soldiers because of the story of these Jewish Germans who go back and fight the people who who have literally killed their families and their homes and their whole backgrounds. But when they come into contact with these enemies, they don't do revenge. They follow the rules. And some of the cases were extraordinary. I had a story that I write about in the book of one of the main characters who all of the men were part of the denazification campaigns. And after the war, they also were fighting to find Nazis. And his beloved dad had been taken away and murdered at Dachau concentration camp. After the war ends, he's working for the British government doing denazification. He goes to the local police station. He finds out who turned his father in, basically who was responsible for the murder of his own father. And he wrote in his autobiography, I thought about it. I knew I could have taken him to the woods and shot him, but I didn't. I turned him into the police. And even in instances during the war, I have one commando who was interrogating somebody who actually worked at the concentration extermination camp where his mother was murdered. He didn't beat the man up. He sat there very calmly because there was a sense that we are not like these beasts. We are not them. We're going to do it differently. And we're going to do the way that we're supposed to do it as better members of the British military. So the Tarantino movie is a very lovely revenge fantasy. I teach it to my students every few years, but it's completely wrong. And I think that's why so many of the families were upset by it, because there was never a moment. And I did like a full deep dive into the ex-troop where they lost their shit or they murdered or whatever, even though they, you know, they were justified in many senses to do so.
Yeah. And obviously, I mean, Inglourious Basterds, it's not trained to be history. It's sort of like a story that Tarantino might have heard, but then it's through the prism of a stylized 1970s exploitation revenge flick. I don't know. I Spit on Your Grave or something like that. And I had another guest on who was an advisor to a Call of Duty game. And he says that we have this image of Vichy France, and there are these huge Nazi banners everywhere because of that movie. But if you're going to occupy a country, you at least want to give them like the fantasy that they're not being controlled, even though they really are. So there's but anyway, we're not going to waste time talking about the historicity of Inglourious Basterds. But before getting into like the psychology of war, which you touch on, which I think is a very important thing, I'm really curious about sourcing. So were the activities of the ex-troop, were these classified for a long period of time or only brought into light? Or was this a story that was known for a long period, but just not given the attention that it should have deserved? What were the sort of sources that you were using as you're writing your book?
Okay, this is a wonderful question. So they were a top secret unit. So when they were taken, all of these men were German or Austrian Jewish exiles who had come to the UK as youth on Kinder transport. When war broke out, Churchill decided that they would intern all of the Germans who lived in the UK. And this, of course, included, you know, all of these young Jewish men. So they were all interned, and then they were chosen to be part of the secret commando unit. Now, the way that the commando unit worked was the British government was very much aware that if any of these men had been captured, they would have been killed immediately as Jews, as Germans, and as commandos. So when they created this unit, they had them take up the pretense that they were a British unit. It was actually called the British Unit of 10 Commando. So all of the men were given, well, they chose basically in a matter of like 15 minutes, fake names that sounded British, fake backstories. They all were going to be buried under crosses as Church of England. And it was completely top secret. And no one even knew the names of their original group of men until like decades after the war. And the men continued to not talk about this as well. They kept it completely top secret. So when I decided to write this book, it was very complicated because a number of the files were still classified. So I had to go to the Home Office and get them declassified. But on the other hand, over the last, since basically the 1970s, a few different military historians had sort of vaguely knew that there was this existence of this unit. There was this great military historian called Ian Deere, who recorded all of the ones he could find in the 1980s and put the recordings in the Imperial War Museum. So I had all those recordings. There was a documentary filmmaker in LA who sort of vaguely knew about these men, and he recorded a bunch of them. So I got to use his recordings. And then as I started to work on it, I started to connect up with the families and found to my complete astonishment that two of the men were still alive. So I was actually able to interview two of the commandos. The other source for all of my material was, of course, the war diaries. Britain kept incredible war diaries of all their campaigns. So when I would have a story that I would hear from a child of a commando, or I would see some letters about it, or I would have family material on it, I always made sure that I would go to Q in the UK. I would go into the war diaries and make sure that the memories matched the reality of it. So it was a lot of making these connections between what did the war diaries say, who do they talk about, and how do people remember it? And to my astonishment and complete joy, they matched every time. I mean, I would find people would remember this, or they, you know, a lot of these guys, you know, when they were older, they wrote sort of diaries or, you know, self-published autobiographies. So I had that stuff. And it was often a job of matching their memories with the reality, which, like I said, to my astonishment, almost always matched. It was incredible. So when I start to write the book and I start to get in touch with families and, you know, reach out to people, I very much got the sense that people have been waiting their whole lives to have someone come along to get to write this book. So I felt the luckiest person in the world that I can't even tell you how deeply and profoundly grateful I was. And the stories that came out from the families, I interviewed them, I sat with them, I saw, you know, their family archives, but everything, you know, would go between the families and then the different archives. Some of them are in the Imperial War Museum, some are in the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, and trying to match the two together. So it was a lot of deep dive research and getting things declassified as well.
And for listeners who aren't historians, that must have felt like a eureka moment, because there's so much of history when you're in the archives that people imagine who aren't historians, if you go into archives, oh, there's little bundles. This is this person's story, beginning, middle, and end. And you just, you know, pick it out and neatly read it. No, it's just like a vast ocean of disorganized fragments. Sometimes you can find a story, usually you can't. So we have to use cheats like prosopography and say, well, this probably would have happened because they're this type of person, but we really don't know. So yeah, that's amazing that you found that.
There was this great moment where, you know, one of the three men, I tell you the whole story of the unit, but I talk in particular of three of the men. Primarily, I chose them originally because they had the most material and I needed material. And also, as strange as it sounds, I wanted to do a very optimistic story about World War II and the Holocaust, which barely exists. So I also wanted people who survived and lived long, full lives. And so one of the men I write about, Manfred Ganz, in the book, he's like a total superhero. Like at the front of every battle, capturing, killing Nazis, like complete, utter superhero. And at one moment I found a war diary talking about one of these commando moments that the unit he was in after the landing at D-Day. And it said something like, and usually these war diaries are never personal, but it said something like, and Freddie Gray, because that was the nom de guerre that he was using. Freddie Gray went on, you know, went across enemy lines to get some intel and he didn't come back. But we all said to ourselves, it's Freddie Gray, he'll come back. And of course the next morning he came back. And as I read that, I thought he really was that Superman. Like they looked at him that way too, when he sort of walked back after doing this top secret thing. So I had a lot of those moments where I would find them listed in the war diaries and it would match the memories of what people had about them. It was beautiful and lots of eureka moments, actually.
Hmm. This commando unit, so I'd like to talk about where the idea comes from to form it, because there's a book that came out a couple years ago called Return to the Reich about a Jewish refugee who flees Nazi Germany. He comes to the United States, goes back as intelligence officer. Now, it makes a lot of sense that German Jews would be involved in this, because there's a Venn diagram overlap of those who are fluent in German or native in German, those who know German culture, and those who resist Nazi Germany. And that Venn diagram overlap perfectly corresponds to Jewish refugees. But it's sort of like they're people who have these qualities who happen to be Jewish who are recruited. But this is different. This is the British military specifically recruiting German refugees. And the idea of Inglourious Basterds, that these are people who want to do, they would be so burning with anger that they would do some kind of Vlad the Impaler psychological warfare, hack and slash brutal type of revenge thing. The idea that Quentin Tarantino takes, you say that it's not like this at all, but as the British military is thinking about putting this unit, I could see people arguing, well, can we trust them with sensitive operations? Or so can you describe how the idea comes together to put together this unit?
Okay, so it's the summer of 1942, and things are going pretty bad for the Brits at this point. And they start to come up with this idea that we're going to start using commando units much more than we have to do, you know, go behind enemy lines, gather intel, and so on and so forth. And it comes to them that they're going to create a special commando unit called 10 Commando. And 10 Commando is going to be comprised of people who were under the rule of the Nazis and now have made their way to the UK. So there's going to be a French unit in 10 Commando. There's going to be a Belgian unit in in 10 Commando. And then what Churchill decides is within this group, we're actually going to have a unit of German speakers. And we're going to create something very special called X-Troop. And the reason it's going to be really important to us is A, as you said, because they speak German. Secondly, because they have knowledge of the land. They've been there. They know it. They know locations. And third is because they are going to be burning with a profound and intense desire to right the world that the Nazis have completely and utterly destroyed. So when they go to, at this point, these German Jews, they've already been interned in often very horrific situations during the war. They're let out of internment and told that the only way that they can be out of internment is if they fight for something called the Pioneer Corps, which is part of the British military. Well, the Pioneer Corps is a hard labor unit. They're the guys who build bridges and, you know, take care of trucks. They don't get any arms. They're not allowed to fight. So there's all of these German Jews who are in the Pioneer Corps. They're constantly writing to their bosses to say, you got to let me out of here. I want to fight. I want to go fight. And then it dawns on Churchill and the other top brass, wait, let's use these guys. So they go to the Pioneer Corps and they start to recruit these guys from all these different units in the Pioneer Corps. Now, the fact of the matter is that 95% of them are Jewish, but it was never thought of that we're going to pick them because they're Jewish. We're going to pick them because they're German and they've left and they have the language skills. But once they start to put the unit together, and as I said, they all had to pretend they were British. So they all had to burn everything they had that had their own, their past lives on them. And as they start to train them, and they train them for like 1 to 2 years, some of them are sent off earlier to go to Sicily, others stay all the way through D-Day. It starts to become evident to the person who's training them, this Welsh officer named Brian Hilton Jones. He's not Jewish, but he knows German fluently. He's in charge of training them, that these men are extraordinary. I mean, they're smart, they're focused, they're dedicated. You know, most of them come from these very cultured backgrounds, and they're teaching them to mountain climb and parachute jump and do all of these different things. And he realizes that unlike the other units of 10 Commando, unlike the French unit or the Belgian unit, these guys are so extraordinary that they must never fight together as a cohesive unit. In fact, what they need to do is be parceled out to other existing units in the British military because they're going to be so important. So they never fought together. And then they're put in twos and threes and fives and six to all the existing British commando units. And the other idea about this was that, look, if let's say a bomb goes off, we can't wipe out this unit because it's too important to us. So we have to parse people out. So once the war is underway, the different leaders of the different commando units think, holy crap, these guys can get me intelligence. They can go behind enemy lines. And most crucially, they can capture Germans and interrogate them on the battlefield. Nobody had ever done this before, rather than taking them back to the base. So they were completely different from all the other commando units because they were all trained in counterintelligence and in commando. I say in the book, they were brains and brawn. They had to be able to fight and think on their feet. And so then during the course of the war, they become the tip of the spear in all the major campaigns, but in small little groups, helping these different commando units lead the way. And the fact that they're Jewish, once they took on their British personas, they don't talk about it anymore. Some of them were Orthodox Jews. Many of them, their parents had converted to Christianity when they were kids because they thought it would make their kids safer with the rise of Nazism. But the whole Jewish aspect is totally sublimated. And for many of them, it stays sublimated until long after the war. And their kids never find out that they were actually German Jews and their background. So it's very interesting. But when they took on this commando and counterintelligence sort of officer idea persona within themselves, it was very clear to them that revenge was not going to be an option, no matter how much. And all of them, I have to say, fought with a complete and total burning desire to get back to Germany to win the war and to try and make the world better, because they had lost everything, literally everything, these men.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Hey, guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from, with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
War has played a key role in the history of the United States, from the nation's founding right down to the present. Wars made the United States independent, kept it together, increased its size, and established it as a global superpower. Hi, I'm James Early, host of the Key Battles of American History podcast. In each episode, I discuss American history through the lens of the most important battles of America's wars. To start listening now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search Key Battles of American History on your favorite podcasting platform.
Before getting into the specific battles are involved in for D-Day, Battle of the Bulge, etc., tell me about some of the main people in your book. What are their qualities that cause them to rise to the top, that they're selected for important counterintelligence missions, and what makes them stand out?
All right, I'll talk about a couple of them. One of them is Manfred Ganz, who I talked about earlier, who becomes this kind of Superman. Freddie Gray is the gnome de guerre that he takes on. He comes from an Orthodox Jewish family, which is unusual. Most German Jews at this time are not Orthodox Jewish. So he's raised completely Orthodox Jewish. His family see the writing on the wall and they send him alone to England by himself as a teenager. All of them are sent by themselves as teenagers. And once he gets to England, he decides he wants to be an engineer. He wants to be a chemical engineer, but then the war breaks out and then he's interned, like all the others are interned. And then he, goes into the Pioneer Corps, begs them to let him go fight, and they start to recognize that he is extremely intelligent and fantastically focused. So he rises up immediately. He's actually sent, I think it was to Cambridge, to do sort of extra counterintelligence training as well. And when the war breaks out, he's the guy who's always at the front, but he always has a cool head. He's very level-headed. Now, the reason he has a cool head, and I can talk about this later if you want, is when he goes into the military, his parents go into hiding, right? His parents, who he loves more than anything, they go into hiding. He gets a letter saying his parents have been caught. They were turned in and they've been taken away to a concentration camp, to Bergen-Belsen, which is one of the worst of the worst. He gets that letter and he says, right, that's it. I'm going to A, make sure that the British beat the Nazis and the Germans, and B, I'm going to rescue my parents. And so from that moment, that was the burning focus that he had. And so it meant that he would do the bravest things, but be very cool-headed about it, because he had to survive to go rescue his parents. So that was one of the most extraordinary stories I wrote about. And I can talk later if you want about if he does do that. And then as well, you know, there was this beautiful young commando named Peter Masters, who grew up in Vienna. His family was very cultured. He wanted to be an artist and he was very sort of sensitive. And he goes, as happens, he gets sent over to the UK, gets in turn, same story with him. And for him, it was really complicated because it had a very sort of sensitive artistic nature. And so while he's doing his training, commando training, like I said, 1 to 2 years of hardcore intense commando training, he wrote a beautiful autobiography about it. And he wrote about like the shock of someone like him suddenly being able to be blindfolded and put together a gun without even thinking about it. Like he took to it completely, but at the same time he kept his artistic impulses. And part of what I have in the book are these phenomenal paintings and drawings he did as he underwent the war. And he took these detailed, you know, drawings, which he wasn't supposed to do, but he did in his diaries. And so he actually survives the war, finds himself being very heroic, and then becomes an important artist in the United States. So all of them have these deep narrative arcs, but they're driven to a man by this idea, we have to stop these people because they're destroying all of our people as well.
Yeah, and we'll definitely circle back to their stories for Peter Masters, his bicycle ride through France, and Freddie Gray's rescue mission. But for these commandos, when are they first involved in counterespionage? Is it before D-Day, during, or what is their first action that they see?
So that's one of the more top secret elements that I've been able to uncover some of it, but not all of it. So before D-Day happens, they are sent on missions across enemy lines. And I have it written down in diaries. You know, one of the guys who is a really trustworthy source says, I was sent over to France a few times to do counterintelligence. He doesn't give any details, right? But one of the most important stories is this counterintelligence moment that happens in the weeks before D-Day, when one of the leading commandos, a guy named George Lane, that's his nom de guerre, he's married at this point to Miriam Rothschild of the Rothschild families. She's working for the Enigma campaign with Turing. And so she has all this sort of deep access to this element of World War II. And then he is sent in the weeks before D-Day because they start to receive word that possibly the Germans have set up these underwater bombs, right? That could do a different kind of, that they're not the standard Teller bomb. There's something different about these underwater bombs. And the worry is that if they do the massive D-Day landing, it will be a complete slaughter. So they send George Lane and his officer, the Welsh officer, Brian Hilton Jones, to do a series of excursions into France to try and figure out what these underwater bombs are. And so during one of the nights that he sent there so he goes over there, he has to swim, he has to ideally capture a bomb. He actually captures and brings back a bomb to the Brits. And they realize that this is a standard Teller bomb. It's not something unusual. They can still do D-Day. But they're so worried about it, they send him to do a third trip over. And it's during his third trip over that he's captured by the Germans. And in one of this, I mean, so much of the book was so much stranger than fiction. He's brought to be interrogated to the chateau in France. He's brought into this room. Remember, he's in deep cover. He's pretending he's British. And he decides, Jesus, they're going to figure out that I have a really strong German accent, even when I'm pretending to speak English. So I'm going to do a Welsh accent. So he makes it sound very strange. They send him into this big library, and lo and behold, it's Rommel himself turns around and interrogates George Lane, not realizing George Lane is actually a Jew who's originally from Budapest. And Rommel wrote about it afterwards, having this interesting encounter with this Welshman. And he never loses his cover, and they have this very interesting conversation that I write about in the book. And after the war, when he's given his awards, it says outright in the award, this your action here allowed us to do D-Day because he found out about the bombs. So they were doing stuff behind enemy lines, but a lot of it is still I can't find the specifics of it. I just have the general of it.
This is a question. It's a bit of a Hail Mary, but I did an episode on Nancy Wake, who was a New Zealand journalist that was part of the French resistance, French underground. She was a journalist before the war and had a French husband. Did any of these counterintelligence or counter people ever cross her path, as far as you know?
No.
Okay.
I mean,
I figured, but you know, yeah. I figured it was worth asking.
Basically, I wanted to have some women in the book, and the only woman who becomes prominent in my book is the amazing Miriam Rothschild. She was extraordinary. And she was married to George Lane, that person who had the contact with Rommel. And she's the person doing really important Enigma stuff while the war's going on. But she's the only woman that I come across in my book who becomes prominent.
All right. Yeah.
And by the way, she's also arrested, you know, while they're in training in Wales, because she is obsessed with pigeons and she has a bunch of pigeons under her bed and they think that she's a spy. And then her brother, you know, she's a Rothschild and she gets out of the jail, but so on and so forth. But if they came into contact with her, they didn't leave records of it.
What does it look like for them to gather intelligence? How do they do this as they're in France and other places? Are they talking to villages? Because if you have a British persona, how are they going about doing this? I'm very curious.
Yeah, it's actually very funny. When they did their training, and they were sent to Wales to do their training of all places. And because they were commandos, in the British Army, if you're a commando, you don't stay in a barrack. You're given money and you go find a local place to stay. And after the war, one of the Welsh villagers said of these young men she said they were all very, very polite. And they always said, "They are English." So everyone knew that there was something super weird about this group. But nobody really asked it because the local police knew we're not going to delve into this stuff. So when they go and they're in France and they're in these, you know, when they're making their way after D-Day, what was so extraordinary about them, and I write about in the book, like even when they landed on Sword Beach, right? They land on Sword Beach on D-Day. Manfred Ganz, Freddie Gray, is Nom de Guerre, like I said, is the Superman. And he, you know, goes right to the front. He gets to the beach and he sees that there's a bunch of Brits who've captured some Germans. And he goes up to the Germans. And he says to them, obviously in fluent German, "You need to show me right now where the mines are so we can get off the beach." And I think they were so shocked that there was this ostensibly British man speaking fluent German to them. They showed him the way off the beach. And then he was able to safely take his group off of Sword Beach. And that group of his men survived. So oftentimes it was these moments where immediately they would be there and they would do this deep interrogation and they would get that intel right then. There's another moment when Freddie Gray has landed at Walcheren, because there's a Walcheren campaign happening with this other commando called Maurice Latimer. And he realizes that they don't have any tank backup to take the island. So he thinks, all right, I'm just going to do this myself. So he starts walking towards this lighthouse that they know is packed with Germans that they have to take. And a German comes out of the lighthouse, one of the officers, and says, "What are you doing here?" And he says in German, "Well, I'm here to take the lighthouse." And then he decides himself, "I'm going to actually have a conversation with this guy in German." And as he's having the conversation with himself, behind the German guy, he watches his fellow commando, Maurice Latimer, sneak behind the officer and go into the lighthouse. And then while he's talking to this officer, he watches Maurice Latimer lead all of the Germans out that he had just captured. So this happens over and over again, that stunning moment where the Germans go, "Why? How does this guy know fluent German?" And it kept happening throughout the war because they all look British. They all have British persona. You know, they all have fake names and everything. And I think the shock of it often led to the intel. But the intel continues after the war. These guys are all really important in the denazification campaigns and interrogating, capturing Nazis and getting information for the Nuremberg trials and so on and so forth as well.
I mean, that must have, yeah, a mental shock. I could see people divulging things that maybe they wouldn't have expected because mentally they're prepared for, a British person who maybe studied German at Oxford and is speaking, but with a thick accent. So they have the walls put up. But then when someone comes at them speaking as a countryman, "Wait, what? Are you German, but you are captured? Or what is this?"
Oh, it was actually very funny because, you know, some of these men, like this guy I write about who was so extraordinary called Ian Harris, when he was living in Germany, his parents sent him to this boarding school. And it turned out to be a boarding school that would be really important for building up young Nazis. And they did all this sort of Nazi training at the boarding school. He's Jewish. When they figure out he's Jewish, they beat the crap out of him and he leaves. But afterwards, during the war itself, at one point, I write, he catches an entire German unit, like hundreds and hundreds of Germans. And he remembers what he learned in his high school about sort of Nazi rules and how you command people. And he starts to employ all the military terms he remembered from being this Jewish kid at this young, budding Nazi boarding school. And the guys just obey him. And he does all, and this happens a lot when they, a lot of times when these commandos captain Germans, they're given like, here's 100 Germans, you have to walk them to the beach. And they all went back to their early training and used those terms that they remembered. And I think the Germans were just so stunned that they obeyed them in like every single instance for those who wrote about it.
Yeah, their soldier instinct would kick in when they're given orders using specific terminology.
Exactly.
Huh.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, these commandos are involved in major contests. There's D-Day, Battle of the Bulge. What sort of other critical intelligence do they capture? And what are other notable actions during this time as the Allies are moving through Europe?
So there might have been other groups that I don't have intelligence about. But what I know about is that the first group was actually sent to Sicily for the Sicily landings. And they were sent, there was only four of them, were sent on the very, very first of the very front boats to land at Sicily. And that group ends up being really important in the war effort in Italy. And it's very strange because these guys don't know Italian, but there's this presumption that because they're very intelligent and they're German speakers, they can pick up Italian quickly and be used for intelligence. And that ends up happening actually. So they end up being very important for intelligence gathering. They go again, what they would do is they would go ahead of the troops, gather intelligence and come back. But their most crucial places were at D-Day, where these guys were all constantly being sent beyond enemy lines. I mean, the story that I think is pretty emblematic is Peter Masters. Can I talk about
that? Yes, please.
So Peter Masters, like I said, the sensitive, beautiful young artist from Vienna. Well, when he lives in Vienna, he rides a bike everywhere, which, you know, may seem mild, but it ends up being very important to him. Because when the guys are at Southampton and they're being, like I said, all the ex-troopers are parceled out into other existing commando units. And all of these commando units are under the head of Lord Lovett. So he's in charge of all the commando units, right? So the day before they're about to take off, one of the ex-troopers comes to him and says, hey, you can ride a bike. And he says, yeah, I can ride a bike. And he said, well, you want to be part of the bicycle unit. And he thinks, well, what's that? And it turns out that there's a special unit of bicycle riders riding these incredibly clunky, bizarre, foldable bikes that basically have no pedals. And as one of another commander from a different unit said, there's no worse thing you want to be on during D-Day than is a bike. But the idea was that if you had a bike, you could zip across. And so he's given the job with the bicycle unit that when they land at Sword Beach, they're going to zip across and make their way to Pegasus Bridge, because Howard has landed there with all the advanced units and they're going to go to help the guys at Pegasus Bridge, right? And Peter Masters ends up being part of that group. That's the very first one across Pegasus Bridge. But he's also important because he helps that unit survive to actually get to Pegasus Bridge, because there's this great moment right after the landings that I write about in the book, where Peter Masters becomes aware, as many of the men do, that their commanding officers in whichever unit they're sent to are looking at them a little bit strangely, because they are picking up that they have German accents. They know that they haven't trained with these guys. They're kind of being given to them in like moments before the war starts. And he starts to think to himself, I think this guy thinks I'm completely expendable. Now, Brian Helton Jones had said to him before the war, he said to all the men, make yourselves valuable, nudge them, constantly ask to do things. So he keeps going to the head of his commando unit and saying, can you please send me to gather intelligence? Can you please send me to, you know, do what I'm trained to do? The guy is not interested at all. And they get to this little French village and they realize that there's a German machine gun nest in the French village. And then the guy says to him, okay, you go figure out where that machine gun nest is. And Peter Masters says, okay, so you want me to go around the village and kind of sneak in the back? And the guy says, nope, I want you to walk down the street and figure out where the nest is. And Peter Masters thinks, oh crap, they're sending me out to pull out the guns to figure out where the nest is. That's why they're sending me to do this. And it's extraordinary. And he doesn't think to himself, damn these Brits. I can't believe they're doing that. He actually thinks to himself, you know what? This makes some sense. I'm going to do this. If this what it is what it takes to beat the Nazis, I'm going to do this thing. And so he starts walking down the road, and he remembers a movie he'd seen in which an officer pretends to know more than he knows. So he starts yelling out in German, "We have you captured, put down your arms." And he starts to sound so authoritative that the Germans don't respond and don't shoot him. And then he gets a few seconds of time for the Germans then to stand up and aim their machine gun. And that gives the rest of the bicycle troop the time to pull their own guns up, and they charge and they take the German machine gun nest. And this kind of stuff happens over and over again. And also, of course, Peter Masters then at that point is sent to one of the men who's dying, one of the German men, and to say, all right, so where are the rest of the Germans? And that's how it would go. So then he would find out where the rest of the Germans are, and then the troop would continue moving forward over and over and over again.
So he's just clearing out these defensive perimeters to...
Yeah, and getting that intel. Right then, what do you do with this intel? This is what you do.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
After Teddy Roosevelt's failed third-party presidential run, he thought that he would reassemble the Rough Riders for a final charge against the Germans in World War I by launching a cavalry attack against 50-caliber machine guns. Here's an interview with Bill Hazelgrove to look at this incredible story.
Teddy Roosevelt was one of these people who seemed indestructible. And that's why I think a lot of Americans wanted him to go, because in a way, he was their Superman.
To listen to this full interview, check out the History Unplugged podcast on the podcast player of your choice. One of the best works of art about World War I isn't Johnny Got His Gun or 1917, but the Swedish heavy metal band Sabaton's album, The Great War. Here's lead singer Joachim Broder.
From a more general point of view, I feel like our music, from the emotional spectrum, I guess, that's in our music, it's pretty emotionally close to what you'd find on the battlefield or in history. There is obviously the aggression, sometimes a sense of joy and pride, sometimes depression, and all of these things.
You can listen to our full interview on the History Unplugged podcast, and you can find it on the podcast player of your choice.
So the other story you alluded to earlier, this is very interesting. When Freddie Gray wants to rescue his parents, as you mentioned, so how does he do this? How does this fit in with the scope of everything that's happening in Europe at the time?
Okay, so Freddie Gray has decided, like I said, he's going to rescue his parents. He thinks they're at Bergen-Belsen. Then he gets a letter in the sort of waning months of the war when it looks like the Brits are going to win. And it says that his parents, it's a letter from the Red Cross saying that his beloved parents have been moved to Terezin, where there's a concentration camp in Czechoslovakia. And he says, I'm going to get them out. So when there's about two more days of the war, he can't go before. He's asked before, but they're not giving him permission to do this. But at this point, he's such an important member of his commando unit that he goes to the officer and the officer, by the way, he's already been promoted multiple times, and commanding officer knows the real story of who he is. So after one of the times that he's promoted, he's actually said, the guy says to him, like, who are you really? Come on, like, we hear that, who are, and he says, actually, I'm an Orthodox Jew from Germany. So he knows who he is, and his officer says, okay, you know what? I'm going to give you a Jeep. I'm going to give you a driver, and best of luck to you. And the war is still going on. There's not the end of the war yet. So he takes his Jeep, he takes his driver. And in the final 2 days of the war, he drives through this apocalyptic landscape of Germany and Czechoslovakia. He keeps crossing with Russian troops who have never met someone like him before. He goes to towns where the Sudeten Germans, because a lot of Germany was completely untouched at this point, are wandering around and saying, we're so scared of the Russians, please rescue us. And he would say, you guys basically brought this on yourself. And he drives with this fury across Europe, and he gets to Czechoslovakia. He gets to the concentration camp literally hours after it's been taken by the Russians. And there's Russian men at the front of the concentration camp, and they're shocked. Like, this British officer has shown up from basically nowhere. And he says to them, I need to get in there because my parents are in there. And I think because they're so shocked, they say, all right, but listen, We have, there's a lot of sickness in the camp. There's typhus, there's terrible epidemics. You can come in, but you have to leave within like 24 hours. And so, and he kept a diary of all this, which is in the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. And so he goes into the camp, the gates open, and it's the worst hellscape anyone can imagine. We can all visualize what it was like. Dead and dying Jews everywhere. And, you know, this is a guy who's had to pretend he's not Jewish. He's Orthodox. And suddenly he's around Jewish people too. And it just, he said that it was like when he would jump out of a plane and do a parachute landing, he just felt everything kind of drop inside of himself. And he said that he had spent years having no emotions during the war because he was going to be this very focused fighter. And suddenly he starts to feel things. Because the Germans are so sick, they keep very detailed records as we know of everything. And of course, there's a camp office that he can go to. And there's a Jewish woman in the office. And he says to the woman, look, I'm trying to find my parents. And she's shocked. And she says, well, what's their name? And he says his parents' names. And then she looks in the big logbook and she bursts into tears. And she says, you're never going to believe it, but they're still alive. I will take you to your parents. And so he gets back in the Jeep and like it is a complete hellscape. Everyone's dying all over the place. It's just horrific. They drive to the Dutch colony. It's called the Dutch colony because his parents had been caught hiding in the Netherlands. So it's called the Dutch colony. They go and he says to the woman, because he's always a thinker, and he says, look, you need to kind of prepare them for this because I'm scared the shock will kill them. So she goes into the building, comes back and says, come inside. And the reunion is unbelievable. I can't even describe it. It's all in his diary, in his own words. His dad's so skinny, he doesn't recognize him. His parents managed to survive because his mom got a job in the kitchen. They've been living on one slice of bread a day. They're both clearly near death. And he spends the whole night talking with them. The Russians allow him to spend the night there. He finds out about it. All of his extended family, of course, has been killed in the Holocaust. And the word gets out to the camp that a Jew has survived. A child has come back. So all of the sort of living Jewish people in the camp start coming to the apartment. And everyone's just yelling, Mazel Tov. And it's just a moment of profound hope. And then he leaves them a bunch of cigarettes and food that he brought. And he says, I'm going to get you out, because they're not allowed to leave because of the epidemic. And they're also far too weak to leave. He gets back in the Jeep. He drives straight back to the Allied side. He goes that day, because this is Freddie Gray. He finds Princess Julia of the Netherlands, who had been living in Canada, is now back in the Netherlands. And he gets a meeting with her and says, you have to get my family out of this concentration camp. The whole Dutch colony is there and they're dying. And she sets up some trucks and his parents are rescued and they live a long and beautiful life together. And I have these photos of them, you know, in their elder stages. And after the war, his mother told someone who interviewed her, she said, if anyone was going to come rescue us, it would have been Manfred Gans, Freddie Gray. Like, we knew if it would ever happen, it would be him. And final point is, after this happens, it's so extraordinary that Freddie Gray, during the denazification efforts, he's sent to a lot of places that previously had Jews in them, in Germany. And he starts to realize people have heard the story of this. And when he goes to certain places, they say, oh my God, you're the commander who rescued your parents from the concentration camp. So I think it also gave a deep well of hope to a number of people, including his own parents, who later said, we were able to survive those last few days because we knew he was out there waiting for us. And his brothers both survived too, as well. So one fights in the Jewish brigade and one sort of stays in an Orthodox boarding house in London throughout the war.
I can imagine the story would spread because it's a glimmer of hope for people in concentration camps who've had nothing but years of misery.
Yeah.
You talk to living members of this commando unit, and I wonder, what was it that stuck out to you as you talked to them? How do they filter the war? Because they have, I mean, the highest highs, the lowest lows, where their people are being destroyed, their religious brethren or ethnic brethren, depending on how you want to define Jewishness. But so on one hand, some of them must have felt their blood boiling, so they have a chance to be able to do something. They see this absolute hellscape, but then they're able to provide people hope. So how do they describe this as you talk to them?
Okay, that's such a great question. So I'll tell you sort of three quick anecdotes. One person, actually, who I didn't get to interview, who's like a big star in my book, this guy called Ian Harris, who's the one who captured hundreds of Germans, and he's like crazy heroic. Just he had a quote before he died where he said, "I was always eternally grateful to the British. They gave me a gun, they gave me grenades, they said, hey guy, you go fight, and they let me fight." So for someone like him, he was so grateful. And when he died, he went to his son and said, "I want you to do something really special when I die at my funeral." And he dies in his 90s. And so after he died, they played the bugle music at his, because he was in the military. And his son stands up and he puts his fingers in the air and he says, "Up yours, Adolf." So he just felt, I mean, it's such a great story, but he just felt vindicated, and he talked his whole life about how great it was he got to fight. Now, the two people I spoke to, it's a little bit different. One of them, I was able to interview him through his daughter before he passed away, Paul Streeton, who became one of the most important economists in the world. And one of the things he said to me that I thought was so interesting, I said to him, "So how did this impact on you, having served in the X Troop?" And he said it was really interesting because on the one hand, it taught him to be much stronger than he ever thought he could be. He could be a warrior and he could fight and he could do all these things that he never knew he was capable of doing. On the other hand, though, it taught him to be much kinder and more decent and better man. And I thought that was really interesting. So what he got out of it was this sense of sort of being partially responsible for humanity. And his life was a testament for this. He worked for the World Bank and did all this stuff about the economy of poverty. The other person I spoke with, I had to use as a pseudonym in the book because he's never told anybody that he's a German Jew. He never told anybody that, as he said to me, his parents disappeared without a trace one day during the Holocaust. And he had lived his life as the person he became when he became a British commando fighter. So nobody knew his story and he didn't want me to tell anybody what his real name was. So I flew out and I interviewed him and it was extraordinary. His whole house was filled with art and paintings. He had just published another book of poetry, traveling the world, living the fullest, richest life in the world. But when he talked to me about the X Troop, was something I got from the kids of the commandos as well, was that, look, all of these guys, they join the commando units when they're like 17, 18, they're kids, right? And they're given new names. They get this Welsh officer who is incredibly loving towards them. And I realized this guy kind of becomes their father figure for them. And so the men of the unit were so much more than a band of brothers for them. They became their family. So when he was talking about the ex-troopers, he was talking about the way one would talk about one's brother, because you got to realize they've lost everything. And now they have this new brotherhood of these men. And so when he also talked to me about some of the men who died, he talked about it in the way that he literally had lost his closest brother in those deaths. So it's much more than a band of brothers for these men. It was much more personal because it stepped in at the moment in which all of them had basically lost like everything.
A point you make in the book is that the legacy of the X-Troop in England is that the commando's Jewish heritage was ignored and in some cases it was suppressed. Now, a lot of their activities were classified, but at the same time, many of them never resumed their old identity. They kept up their British identity. So in writing your book and bringing up the story, what do you hope is gained by looking at this perspective of the history of World War II?
That's such a good question. So in a broader thing that's not particularly about World War II, I would say what I hoped was learned from this is how important refugees are and immigrants are for changing cultures for the better. I mean, these guys were outcasts. They were despised. Nobody wanted them. And they came into the UK and they utterly changed it for the better. They helped the Brits win the war. They became really important members of society. So my larger sort of story that I get out of this is how crucial these type of people are to our worlds and our communities. The people we think are the most despised can make the most difference. What I hope we get out of World War II about this story is that there was this remarkable commando unit of German Jews who made really crucial differences in the war, and it's been overlooked, and we need to know their story now. Like, we just need to know what these guys did, because often when we think about World War II and we think about Jews, as we should, we think about Holocaust victims and we think about people being murdered. And this story is very different. It's about Jews fighting back against Germans. There's a picture I put in the book, and it's when Maurice Latimer, one of the commandos at Walcheren, like I said, he emptied out that there was the lighthouse where all the Germans were, that he single-handedly captured all of them. And there's a picture of him that I have in the book walking along with the captured Germans. And Peter Masters, another commando, wrote about that picture, and he said, the picture we always think about when we think about the Holocaust is that picture of that little, there's that very iconic picture of the little Jewish boy and his hands are in the air and the Nazis are pointing their guns at him. And this is a complete reversal of that. This is this Jewish commando walking along with utter power and authority with the captured Germans. So I'm hoping what it does is complicates our understanding of World War II, as well as sort of this, the role of these people within it as well.
Right. And as we said at the beginning, it's not Inglourious Basterds, where it's like a Vlad the Impaler psychological, you know, shock and terror, but a very controlled, measured way to help support and win the war effort. All right. Well, there's a lot more in the book to get into for listeners who want to explore that. And the name of it is X Troop, The Secret Jewish Commandos on World War II. Leah, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
All right, so that is all for the episode today. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jay Carrington, McCrays, Salvador Sanchez, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a three-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.